Good morning, everybody. As advertised in our little ex post yesterday, we are all here and ready to hopefully get into some real meat around the bones of the GNU this morning. Of course, my co-star and co-host in the Burning Platform on the podcast party is none other than Phumelele Mashego.
Hello, Gareth.
Me and the coffee.
You and the coffee. Coffee is an essential part of all of our shows early in the morning.
If anybody doubted how much I missed Sia, when I arrived here, he was like, "Sis, come in."
And let me guess, he treated you as you should be treated, with respect and kindness. Gave you a nice cup of coffee.
Of coffee in his hand.
Right, absolutely. So, but Pums.
I'm excited to be here. I missed you last week.
Mm. And yeah, I was in the weirdest place. I was in Bulgaria.
I saw your Instagram post that nobody smiles there.
Very weird, huh? They honestly don't. We had a waitress who was probably the grumpiest person I've ever seen in my life. I tried to tip her, and she said, no, too complicated.
In my mind, I also think of the Bulgarian girls as a little buxom. Are they?
I must tell you, I was very disappointed. I had these dreams of kind of Eastern European beauties, you know, these kind of, you remember Elton John's Nikita music video of these girls across the wall, yes, with these ice blue eyes who'd been trapped by communism and desperately wanted to be
the same stars at night.
Exactly. Move to the West and find a friend kind of thing. Well, mostly. It's weird. Like anybody under the age of 30, and you can't really tell people's age because they start smoking at like 10, and they wear like Adidas tracksuit pants everywhere. So
wow,
very bizarre. Not a place that was ever on my radar. Yeah, strange. And I mean, obviously, I'm talking about. I actually did some on the ground reporting. I was doing some proper investigative stuff because I went into a town, a little town where they probably never had tourists ever, called Pravits. All right. And this place, I just walked around. And I'll tell you what, they all looked funny at me. First of all, because I had a smile on my face, which you're not meant to do in a country like that. My God, did I want to kiss and hug the people at customs on my way through, as is usual. But it's strange. It's just a strange place. Half of it is, you know, Eastern European, kind of post-Soviet, still getting over that. Ugly concrete block buildings with totalitarian architecture everywhere. The other half is like Western Europe, but 50 years ago?
Churches.
They don't have a lot of mosques in Bulgaria because, of course, they fought the Ottomans in the late 1800s and made themselves very strictly Russian Orthodox. So you see a lot of those gold-domed cathedrals in the style of Russian Orthodox churches. Correct, particularly in Sofia, which is the capital where I spent most of the time. And then you'll hear the morning azan, but it's not like, you know, you'd hear it in.
Really?
Yeah, it's not like you'd hear it in some places. Some parts of Europe, you hear more of a morning azan than you hear church bells.
Not like Turkey.
No, not at all like Turkey. Are we meant to say that, by the way? Are we meant to say Turkey now instead of Turkey? Because I refuse. It's like I say Swaziland. I don't give a shit if they want to be called Eswatini.
Listen, Baba, there's so many. It's like when suddenly everyone was calling it Kiev. Kiev?
Yeah, instead Kiev or Kiev if they thought they were very special.
It's a brave new world.
It's the same way as you get these super pretentious people who are speaking about Paris in English and they go Paris. And you're like, no. It's not Paris unless you are French and you are speaking French to someone. In French, it's acceptable. If you francophone a word in an English sentence, you're just full of shit. That's all. It's the same as I'm going to Kiev. No. It's Kiev in English. So call it Kiev, please. Let's not mess around. Anyway, lots to talk about this morning. And I know that this isn't a travel review. So let's get into it. We have a great guest this morning, someone I love having on the Burning Platform. He's a regular guest. He's someone who we really appreciate the opinions of. He's not a stranger to controversy, though, and he doesn't mind saying what he really thinks, even if it annoys a lot of people. He is none other than Sihle Ngobese. He is Big Daddy Liberty, and here he is in his glory this morning. Shalom.
Morning. Morning, everybody. Good to be on the show. It's been a while.
Yeah, Sihle, it's nice to see you. We've seen you at a couple of our events recently, which I was delighted about. But I know that you've had the last couple of months have been absolutely horrendous in so many ways for you on a personal level, with loss and tragedy. And we're obviously as friends of each other's shows and friends in person. It's great to have you back in the political realm. I noticed that you were tweeting up a storm. You're still saying all the things that need saying. You're asking people questions that they don't want to answer. So well done on that front. Let's get...
Gareth thinks of you fondly. I have you in my prayers.
I was about to say, my detractors were very happy when I disappeared for a while. But I'm back, bitches!
Damn right. Yeah, keep them on their toes. So, all right, Sihle, let's get going because there's so much to talk about. And really, there's never a dull week in South African politics. Currently, they are trying for the umpteenth time to replace the mayor of Tshwane. Currently, we are dealing with certain departments that seem to be performing out of their boots just because they were so shit before. And we see other departments who are doing exactly what they were doing like in the last administration and probably for the last 30 years in many cases. But people are judging the GNU, and I think you get two kinds of people here. You can correct me, Pumi and Sihle, if you think I'm talking nonsense. But I've met two kinds of people. You meet the optimists who are going, look, anything's better than having the ANC in total control of everything. And you get the pessimists who say, oh, this thing's not going to last. It's going to fall apart. You can see the Bella Bill and the NHI Bill, and you can see that Tshwane is an example of how things can go horribly wrong, just like Joburg was before, and PE for that matter. So you're going to find people who like to moan, and there are a lot of South Africans who like to moan.
Yeah,
and
then we love it.
Yes,
this is
we
a
love
South
it.
African. Sure. It's a South African national sport. Don't get it twisted. We love to moan. It's like when we're happy. We're very happy. We love everything. And it just takes one small little thing. You just have to see what happened on Saturday with Argentina, right? Suddenly everybody has like so many things to say about the books and people who can't kick. And this is what we do as South Africans. You can't make us happy. We be like lulled into a
false sense of submission
of happiness.
I agree. But I mean, it's also, a lot of what makes us such a great country happens circumstantially. Like I thought about that terrible weather that we had in KwaZulu-Natal last week, and we're apparently due for another one. I can't believe it. It's like the seasons are in just complete. I got this weather warning this morning about how like Tuesday is going to be 3 degrees. So I saw people stranded on Van Rienen's Pass, all kinds of South Africans, because there isn't anyone in this country who hasn't driven that road at some point. And that N3, especially at that part of the N3, it's already difficult. You got trucks that lose control of their brakes. It's very, very treacherous. And then combine that with
winding.
Yeah. And combine that with terrible weather, where people were stuck in snow, which is a very unusual thing for South Africa. We don't have the means to sort that out like overseas nations that are used to snow do. And yet, despite the fact that
snow trucks.
Yeah, but it could have been a national tragedy, and yet you had all kinds of South Africans coming to their aid. You had farmers pulling up in their tractors. You had guys from the local township coming to help hand out stuff or to pull people out of cars or, do whatever they could. Hot coffee was poured out by businesses in the area for people who were freezing in their cars. I mean, I just love that. I love that we are actually a nation that can deal with adversity. I just hope that this government of national unity allows us to deal with less adversity and to actually start building some growth. And I've seen some green shoots, but how are you feeling, Sihle? Are you overly optimistic or are you more considered?
Where are you on the spectrum?
Yeah, look, I think I like to straddle both perspectives because I think they're rational. Both of them come from a rational place. And South Africans have every right to Be cautious, but at the same time, optimistic, because we've had 30 years effectively of democracy in this country in which disappointment has been the default position for many people. And because disappointment is the default position for many people, we've developed a lingua franca, if you will, that insulates ourselves from the ill feeling of being optimistic about something and being disappointed by that same thing. The whole ANC's brand effectively is built on that. Its whole membership is built on that. You know, people who have grown very accustomed to, in order to save face for the disappointments of what they've been for the last 30 years, have now become cheerleaders for the intent of the ANC in government and not the outcomes of what they've been in government. So this new GNU, this effectively a grand coalition of various political parties that stem from, you know, liberals to commies, is going to be something which, you know, a lot of South Africans, again, will have to fight beyond that feeling of wanting to insulate themselves from the disappointment, if there ever were to be disappointment. But here's the thing. That little bit of optimism that we have extended this new arrangement has rewarded us to an extent. I mean, you used the word, Gareth, now, green shoots. We're seeing exactly that. There are flashes in the pan, or flash in the pan moments from especially certain ministers, and let me be precise and specific, ministers who come from opposition parties, who are effectively injecting a new energy into what we've always assumed it will be a dull, insipid, and sort of vacuous national governance track record of delivery. But here are these individuals seemingly coming out of the woodwork, in a sense, saying, actually, no, government shouldn't be that. And yes, there will be a lot of problems insofar as how big this government is, how bloated it is. But insofar as what we have, and in the world of the kind that we live in, they are actually proving to be very energetic, bringing a new impetus to this government. And you're finding now, as a final point, that that scale I spoke of wanting to insulate oneself and not be too optimistic, and on the other hand, actually expressing that optimism, is tilting ever slowly towards the optimism side. And that should be encouraged.
Sihle, you're in KZN most of the time. So I'm quite interested to know how the KZN landscape, because this was, for the rest of us watching, quite a moment, right? With MK 6 months out of the gate, performing phenomenally. And then even that province coming to some semblance of a coalition. What does that feel like? Do you see any of the same kind of national optimism also reflected in the KZN landscape? How is the new setup working, if at all?
KZN is the interesting one, isn't it? In the sense that, on the one hand, a lot of us felt like we dodged a bullet insofar as MK Party having not been able to, because of how they conducted themselves, frankly. You know, here's a new formation, barely 6 months old party, filled, unfortunately, for as much as we call it a new party, it was new party, old people in it, the same old people, who, ironically, KZN people, and this is my personal opinion, please, people, don't think this is, you know, some sort of sage advice or sage insight, but it's my personal opinion. It was a new party with old people in it, and unfortunately, it was the beneficiary of a KZN citizenry who were sick and tired of the ANC. Sick and tired, like, yes, much like the rest of the country, but in this instance, there was a mass formation of people who were basically saying the ANC is not coming back. And again, don't take it from me. Look at some of my content. When we did the What South Africa Can Be campaign, the first iteration of it, you know, just before the election, we were traveling around the country talking to people. We devoted an entire episode to speaking to KZN folk on the ground, on the streets of Durban, Midlands, you name it. And people were saying it outright at that stage. You know, people who are usually very coy around who they'd vote for are saying, no, that's it, we're done with the ANC. And most people at the time, insofar as the opinions garnered, were heading in two directions. One, MK Party, the writing was very clear on the wall in that regard, but also IFP. I could quickly see we're going to make a resurgence in the province. And so, again, just to be concise, we dodged a bullet, therefore, insofar as in the formation of government, MK Party And I'll try not to swear here, but they did something. They browned the bed. Yeah, I'll put it that way. and in us dodging the bullets, we then got the very thing that we thought we would not get, which is a government that coalesces around certain principles, in a sense, and embraces the fact that KZN residents were different. Were looking for something different. Now, what do I mean by this? And I'm going to take 30 seconds to just flesh this out. In it looking for something different, the eradication of ANC hegemony was the first big tick. The ANC was, unlike national government where they still retain 40%, in KZN they really were humbled. It was a proper humbling experience. And there was a confluence of factors that went into that. The biggest being the ANC's disdain for the culture of KwaZulu-Natal residents, specifically Zulus. The behavior of top ANC leaders in the run-up to that election, and almost arrogance, and even at times threatening ordinary Zulu individuals with state power, i.e. Sponi Sotuma, the ANC chairperson in KZN, who at an event snatched the mic, if you remember that, from the Zulu traditional prime minister on stage, causing a very embarrassing situation, which riled up the Zulu impi at the time there. I mean, that was a very tense moment. It's sort of downplayed by the media. Oh, pish posh, nothing would have happened. You know, just a few clashes of spears and calabashes. No. That could have been very, very ugly. Because again, we were a wounded nation that had just buried its former king. And at the same time, had just ushered in a new king who we could see hadn't found his feet yet. So to then have an ANC government almost try and use this moment to run roughshod over, that was a very emotional issue at the time. And that for me was the incident that really showed me the ANC's out, and it will be out with proper numbers. Okay, so anyway, because I'm getting a little sidetracked here. Let me come back. The point I was trying to drive it is this. We have obviously then dodged a bullet insofar as the ANC that is in that administration is, in a sense, a minority partner, in a broad sense of speaking. But more importantly, it's an actually humbled partner. It now recognizes where power really lies in society, and that's in the voters. What do I mean by this? Actual MECs who come from the ANC that are in that provincial administration are now actually delivering. It's the weirdest thing. For example, one of the heroes of the incident you guys spoke about at the beginning, you know, people being bogged in snow on the N3 around KZN, was Usboni Sotuma, the very same individual I spoke of, who's now the MEC of Transport. Here's the guy who, you know, leave aside his arrogance, leave aside his how people usually view him, actually said, no, I'm here to serve citizens, and I'll get up. And myself as an MEC, although I have no place being there, directing traffic and the like, but he was making that visible effort. And that's what I feel like we dodged a bullet of in two fronts. One, MK not being in that administration. And two, the ANC, with it being in this coalition, is actually tempered its behavior and is serving people. It's almost revolutionary in a sense. You know, here are people who always talk about the revolution, but actually serving people is the real revolution that we've undergone. So it's been interesting to watch. And as a KZN resident, I know two things are happening, and this is my final last gasp on this. One, Durban is coming back. It is coming back and it's roaring back. And a lot of that has to do with now them having oversight from an IFP MEC who runs COCTA in the province. So they can't actually F up, or else there will be quite literally sanctions against them. So we're now seeing essentially Durban, which is still run by the ANC, itself cleaning house. And ironically, from that cleaning Durban, that analogy worked very nicely because Durban streets are now almost very, very clean. It's almost like the Durban I grew up in a sense. We can actually walk barefoot and not worry about, you know, drug needles and all sorts of nonsense. I digress. So Durban's coming back. And I mentioned Durban because it's important. It is the economic hub, in a sense, of the entire province. And what happens there spillover effect.
More importantly, it also became a symbol for the degradation of KZN. I mean, as Durban started to fall, so people's hopes and dreams for KZN started to fall apart. And I think very literally people were deciding, you know what, if we've got any money, if we've got anything that's worthwhile, we're not going to send it into KZN because that place it's going bad faster than everywhere else.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, you have a situation where people who... Exactly. You have a situation where, at a most basic level, people who have lived in Durban and call that place home, even if they've had to move for economic reasons, have always retained some sense of home in Durban. That's why the N3 at holiday periods is as chock-a-block as it is.
Well, that's why it was clogged this weekend. That's why people were taken out by the snow.
So to then have Durban come back in this way is, first of all, it's a massive relief for those of us who call that place home. But beyond that, and this is the politics of it all, it also signals to ordinary South Africans the change in mentality, how we view politics. People are less loyal now, I would argue, to, you know, I wear a yellow t-shirt and that's it. I will always wear a yellow t-shirt until, as the expression was, Jesus comes back. You know, people are now saying, okay, cool. I might switch to a green t-shirt. I might switch to a blue one. I might switch to a red one, whatever the case may be. And again, I've never been someone who prescribes to people what they should vote for, except to say, just vote for sensible policies. But for me, that's been the massive win of this election. It almost guaranteed to me a situation where no election in this country ever will see one party win in a manner which makes them unaccountable to the voter, in the one hand, and also unaccountable to the Constitution insofar as the need to deliver on its promise.
Wow, that's a lot. But I'm also quite interested because there were so many parties, there were so many people, to hear the perspective of, as we see it now, the election is over, the winners, the losers, and then it's settled. Right, it's kind of settled. Even Parliament, the business of Parliament, is getting underway again. And then there are people who, in my mind, seem to have lost their voice and relevance over the past couple of weeks. Gareth lives in Tshwane, and he's living through the chaos there because of Herman Mashaba, Action SA, DA, Celia Spring, EFF, and how that relationship, how the big GNU relationship has filtered down to municipal level. I mean, we've got an election, a municipal election in 2 years' time, but down to municipal level, how this thing has filtered down. And it's been fascinating for me to watch, particularly in Tshwane with Herman Mashaba and how they have handled themselves. What is your view of some of these big names, Herman Mashaba, Busa and Musi Maimane, all of those kinds of people, and how it's kind of settled? Because they are also in the GNU. Not Herman Mashaba is not in the GNU, but Busa is. Rise of Fancy also, I think, signed up to it. Mm-hmm. And these were some of the shining stars going into this election.
Well, shining stars insofar as how the media, the mainstream media positioned them, but they weren't really shining stars in terms of constituents, because to a large extent, most of the names you mentioned were riding off of the constituency of the DA. We need to be quite frank around that. That's why them now trying to rebrand themselves has become a very painful experience for them, and also sobering one if we talk about Action SA. The realization that actually my existence outside of the DA is very tentative, and you're now seeing them lash out, in my view, because of that. You know, it's an almost, I'm going to ride on how you framed it. You know, losing relevance can be a very sobering experience for people who seek validation from how people talk about them, right? And if the people who are talking about you are no longer glowing in their terms, number one, and number two, the people who gave you what little power you do have are beginning to sort of second guess their support of you, because they'd rather go back to another, you know, bigger pie of where, insofar as where that constituency votes for, then you're now seeing the fruits of that to an extent, where parties are feeling the existential threat, and it's almost a scorched earth policy to an extent. Now, let me be precise and specific, because Gareth also intimated he wanted me to talk on this insofar as Tshwane in particular. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking an interest in this because I'm also moving to Tshwane literally at the end of this month. So I too will become victim or beneficiary of what happens in that metro. But I'll say this. There will be a realignment. And Helen Zille used to say this a lot, 10, 15 years ago. And her key expression was always, there is a fundamental realignment of South African politics that is happening. And no one saw it back then when she used to say this. And I think she was like a fortune teller reading the tarot cards to an extent, insofar as everything she's spoken about, we're seeing happen now, where South Africans are not loyal to political parties anymore. There will now be a body politics in this country of certain constituents based on issues, not on necessarily who they vote for, but issues. And if you speak to those issues, they will lend you their support. And this is where perhaps a party like Action SA is struggling, because what issues are they actually advocating for? Because the issues they began their whole party with are now suddenly fundamentally different. Let me be precise. Here's a party that used to say, oh, let's move away from race and actually become a non-racial party, because racialism is what's killing this country. It really is. And now suddenly Herman Mashaba has become the massive race baiter, in a sense, on social media at least, in the sense where everything is the fault of those evil whites who, because they're abandoning them and, you know, they're abandoning them, as he often puts it, you know, because they want to prioritize black areas or areas that have been previously neglected. I mean, what is that? You know, your base, your constituency, aren't people who've ever even vaguely said that. You know, there aren't people who've said, oh, if you prioritize, Mamelodi versus... I don't know Pretoria that well. Then we'll stop supporting. They've never said that. But the leader of the party has impugned his own base by saying that that's what his voters say. It's the oddest thing ever, where the leader of your party...
I don't think it's odd. It's like, it's so predictable, actually, in some ways, because this is a guy who's floundering. He's desperately trying to find his place in an election where he did quite poorly, and not nearly as well as he had hoped. And, you know, Michael Beaumont and the rest of his structures are out of ideas. So they are going to the old tried and tested thing, which for very basic people still trapped in like the late 90s and trying to find their place in the world. These are the people who they'll appeal to. And it's a tiny, tiny piece of the pie. I'm also sick of having like good people in cities being pitted against each other, whether it's poor people in areas where there are problems with service delivery for various reasons, infrastructurally, resources, whatever it might be. And they get pitted against people who are paying 90% of the taxes in that municipality. You know, it's as if there's one bad guy and one good guy when they're both trying to find a way to make things work. I mean, take the average taxpayer in a you know, built up urban area in South Africa. They're not paying for themselves. They're getting piss poor service, if anything, for their money. What they're doing is they're subsidizing everyone else. And that's across the board in this country. There's nowhere where there's an enclave of people and all they do is just look after themselves. There isn't such a thing in South Africa. There's a redistributive model going on, whether we like it or not. And most people in this country are okay with that because they want everyone's standard of living to improve. So I don't like it when people like Herman Mashaba start relying on that stuff to kind of bring up old bitternesses and resentments, as if that's going to get him a single extra vote at the ballot box. It won't. And that ballot's far off, and he's playing a very dangerous game here, because the people who did support him, the small number of them who were stupid enough to, are now going to find themselves left on the sidewalk, kind of rejected for being moderate, positive, thoughtful, non-racist people. They're going to go like, oh, hang on, these guys are just trying to survive in politics. By the way, I've got to just throw this in here while we are all going on diatribes, and me and Sicily, either way. Pums, yours is still coming. We were going to have Mzwane Lemani on the show this morning. We keep extending, Pumi can back me up on this, we keep extending a hand to MK to give them a chance to come and explain themselves. Again, you know, at the last minute, there's radio silence from these guys. I don't believe that MK know what they stand for. I don't believe that they have a plan other than the survival of the members of that party in a country which is increasingly looking at them going, you people should be in jail, and trying to find a way to survive. No different to Herman Mashaba in this case, except that Herman Mashaba is not necessarily guilty of obvious crimes in the Zondo Commission report. So that's all I have to say about MK. We'll keep trying, guys. But you still have to explain yourself. We still don't know a goddamn thing about what MK stands for.
And again, and I'll be brief, because I know I can go into on tangents. Let me wrap up Action SA and I'll come to MK, because that's an important point. And I've had the privilege, I'll use the word privilege loosely, of having spoken to them, especially ahead of the election. We have a full-on interview with Visvan Reddy, who at the time was their loudest voice, from this spokesperson, forgive me. Action SA have a there's two things acting against them right now, and they can't help it. They're creatures of habit. One, it's the grudge. And no, I don't mean some scary, wet-looking, you know, Asian lady who crawls towards you in a clicked, creepy, eerie click voice. Although the party does look like that at the moment. You know, we have a situation here where these are individuals who are scorned, who come from the DA, having lost electoral positions in a sense at the last electoral conference. They form this new formation, which, by the way, I endorsed, not in the sense that I voted for them or anything like that, but I endorsed in the sense of saying we need more parties like that. In what I thought at the time was another moderate, sensible party that will appeal to that very large, sensible middle in this country who are desperate for parties of this sort of stripe. In the same way, I endorsed what Umusi Maimane was doing with Ibosa, et cetera, et cetera. You know, here are parties that, in effect, we're just trying to say, let's give more options to the to that middle, in a sense, and they're trying to attract away from the ANC. The problem is that grudge I speak of then saw the shift away from attracting from the ANC and attracting and cannibalizing from others within this missing middle. Now, they have every right to do that. They're political parties. They owe no allegiance to each other, even as opposition parties. But one can see as a voter how self-defeating that is. And it is that element which will punish action, say, in the next elections, where that vote who are argued is looking for parties that will chip away further from the ANC, realizing if I lend my vote to these people, they're more interested in chipping away from other opposition parties that are that sensible middle, thus opening the door to the radicals in this country, whether they're on the right or left is irrelevant. But people are very averse in this country to radicals, number one, which leads me to the MK. Because, you know, in me saying this, someone might say, but hang on, you know, here are KZN voters. They voted for something radical as the MK party. And at face value, that might sound true. But in reality, it isn't. Because ahead of the last election, MK didn't present itself as a rabid ultra-left formation, you know, that will, you know, race bait and basically be a green version of the red AFF. You know, here are people who are basically saying, oh, let's coalesce around the victim, with Jacob Zuma, because that victim fought for us as KZN people. And now you can see what the rest of the political establishment is doing to him. And he's the one standing between us and them, right? So they're after him because they're actually really after us. That's the message they pushed in KZN. And that message was exacerbated by how the ANC conducted itself in that province, where ever seemingly there was this narrative that suggested that these people, which is true, that people, the ANC don't care about people, but more than that, they were out to just effectively cannibalize, or rather the word is exploit people in KZN. So people made that shift based on that. The false promise by Uzuma at various rallies, and I'm compiling a stitch of his speeches that he did at various events, because they never held formal events. That's the other thing that's miraculous about MK. They rock up at a shisanyama and just do a little, you know, stand on a pulpit and talk. It was actually kind of amazing in a political sense. But in any event, it was a victimhood narrative that Uzuma has mastered in this country, and he literally galvanized it to get a base in that part of the world. Now, here's the thing. That same base is now ebbing away because, Gareth, you're right. People are beginning to ask the question, what do you actually stand for? Because there's this, whether we like it or not, there is the risk that if one of the coalition partners in KZN breaks away, they could coalesce with MK Party and bring them into power. So people are asking the question, what do these people actually then stand for? And this is where I think MK is in panic mode to an extent right now, because and I'll be brief in this final point. You're seeing them now sort of snatch the likes of Abo Floyd Shivambu in the name of, oh, he'll help us build our policy platform. You know, they've recently released the first salvo in that direction of the eight pillars. So they've beat the EFF by one pillar, cardinal pillar. But the eight pillars of the MK party. And what are those pillars now? A clear definition that they are a formation of the ultra-left. Expropriation, the language of expropriation, the language of more state control that does things on behalf of the people. And because this is South Africa, that slogan is racialized. So on behalf of Blacks in general and Africans in particular, that's the expression they often use. And you're seeing them form this basically alt-EFF, if you will, based on, again, having secured Floyd and the recognition, perhaps, that the Jacob Zuma spectacle or lure is going to wane when this man is, you know, he's getting in the years. I don't know if you guys have seen recent images of Zuma. He's looking a bit frail. And, you know, there's a recognition perhaps that the brand that MK is based on Uzuma won't last that long. So they're trying to rebrand. But the issue is they're rebranding into the same old tired stuff, which ironically KZN people are not for, which is weird.
Which stopped working for the EFF.
Yes, quite literally. So again, it'll be very interesting to see how things shake up. But the one thing I do like, I want to end this particular segment on a positive note, not that I'm ending the segment, it's not my show. Even as I say all of this, these are all the inherent risks of what we're seeing here. But even despite all of this, there is a calm in our politics that has taken over. A calm but progressive, progressive calm, let me coin that expression. A progressive calm that has taken over in the sense that things are calm, but they're moving forward. Yes, it's gradual, which is a good thing in a sense. I don't, you know, as a liberal, I don't believe in radical change. I believe in gradualism, you know, so that people can actually be a part of that change. They can have a say in it. But it's so far in how I view the social cohesion insofar as our politics, that's what's really working well at the moment.
Cool.
EFF. Because you brought up Floyd and that the MK seem to be trying to out EFF the EFF. Another person who's become very, very quiet. And we don't see or hear as much from Julius or the fighters, as it were, as we used to. What do you make of what's happening over there? And again, a couple of months away from an elective conference, they have their people's conference later this year in December. So surely there's some kind of machinations happening behind the closed doors. And what's your speculation?
I have to admit, I'm actually kind of feeling sad for the EFF. Not because I hold any water for them, but because, you know, this spectacular thing they presented themselves to be, to which in the early years of it, at least, you know, there was a fawning by the media in this country for them, you know, because they were going after Jacob Zuma and, you know, they become the unofficial heroes. And by the way, which they capitalized on. I mean, the EFF were very good at branding. They may be copycats of, you know, the sort of Socialist Party of Venezuela in every respect, from look to, yeah. But what they did really well was really market themselves well and brand themselves well to capture a decent sizing of the young vote in this country. And it seems now that we're tired, and I say we broadly as South Africans, we're tired of their messaging, we're tired of their antics, and it sort of run its course, hasn't it? And if you don't have individuals in the party who recognize that threat of, hey, look, we've sort of reached our glass ceiling of this kind of politics, and that now there is a demand by the voter for something a bit more mature. If you don't keep up with the times, then you'll have a situation that's happening right now in the EFF where things look very bleak. And you're going backwards, and no amount of bluster, no amount of rah, 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 I'm Julius Malema, I will beat you down with my words, will mask the fact that you're wounded and gravely wounded at that. And this is what I think, you know, there's almost blood in the water here in the sense, and the sharks are circling. And the biggest shark, ironically, hasn't been the ANC, that is people from the EFF going back to the ANC, but the MK. You know, here's a part that's literally said, you know, we'll eat your lunch first, insofar as, you know, we'll eat your lunch first because we've shown that we're able to eat the ANC's lunch. So this is the real threat to EFF, that EFF, sorry, is facing. Now, what does this really mean? In 20 seconds, I'll say this. It's going to be a bloodbath for them in the upcoming local government elections, because this has always been an area of weakness anyway for the EFF. The EFF is really in the last 6-7 years, I'm being generous, in the last 3-4 years, really began to notch up those few here and there ward wins at, you know, during by-elections, for example. So that doesn't bode well. In other words, the overwhelming majority of councillors, for example, that EFF members have in the various metros, in the various municipalities, are actually PR councillors. That is the proportion of votes and not necessarily councillors based on winning wards. Now, if you're in the EFF and you're a tactician, a political tactician in the party, you should be very worried, because that basically tells you exactly what's about to happen in the local government election. If you've already regressed on PR votes based on what happened nationally, what chance do you have of maintaining right now your PR vote insofar as they translate at a local government election? Number one, first risk. Your second risk is your growth at a ward level. In other words, your ability to win wards has been piss poor so far. I mean, in fact, it's so bad that when they do win a ward, it's always like, what? We won? you know, like they have like this moment of like, oh my goodness. And even the analysts who talk about it will use language that suggests that this is really amazing. I mean, you should watch some of Wayne Sussman's tweets when he talks about this and he references the EFF if it wins the award. It's always very sort of hyperbolic language. Oh, wow, this is really amazing for them. But it shouldn't be when you're a 10-year-old party. That's the point I often make. You're a 10-year-old party. We shouldn't be seeing it as a wonderful revelation that you win a single ward, at a local government election. So, in short, the EFF are heading for a drubbing in this local government election, and you're already seeing its, quote, ground forces, lol, who's the naval forces and who's the air forces, but nonetheless, you're already seeing its ground forces basically say, yeah, I think we're done with this, and we're shifting, ironically, to MK Party. Even in places... Small point. In provinces where the MK Party has had almost no presence, its presence will be created, ironically, by people who are defecting from the EFF to create those branches there. Let me be precise and specific. Here is a former MP of the EFF who, in the Northern Cape, basically said, that's it, I'm done. I'm forming an MK branch there, and watch the space. In the next election, local government election, MK Party might register a bigger presence, not a significant one, but a bigger presence in other provinces outside of KZN, and ironically may even slip in KZN in a sense.
Well, they won a by-election in the Northwest a couple of weeks ago. So, I mean, you see them beginning to make inroads in other provinces, which belies the fact that a lot of people looked at them and said, this is a Zulu party, this is a KZN party. Even over the weekend, there was an enthroning of a chief. Slips my mind. But to see Jacob Zuma there, and I wanted to make the point earlier that it's fascinating for me that they have, I haven't seen this 9-point plan of theirs, these nine pillars of theirs, but it was interesting to listen to Jacob Zuma at this traditional council celebration, as it were, talking about more power to traditional leaders. This is one of the places that he played very well. You know, this is a hand he played very well. When he talks with a forked tongue.
Yeah, exactly.
He tells the people where he is, what they want to hear. And that was fascinating. So to hear you then say that in their pillars, they're advocating for more state control.
You know, it's so funny, like all of these political leaders who aren't doing well. And you know, the ANC did okay, but they obviously were hugely disappointed by their 40-something percent as opposed to something over 50. So it hit them hard, right in the balls. And I think that's a good thing. I think that no matter what happens with this GNU, it's not going to suddenly redound in the ANC's direction if it goes well. There's some people here, someone said in the comments, Cyril will retire a hero if the GNU works. I don't think so. I don't think the GNU has any upside for the ANC other than the survival. Like, they'll survive, but they're not going to grow. Like, if the GNU suddenly delivers, over-delivers, people are going to go, oh, okay, well, we can see that's because of the other parties in the GNU. It's not because of the ANC, because otherwise the ANC would have done well before the GNU. So people are not that stupid. And when you've got something to compare apples and apples to, then you can tell. Yeah.
Speaking of, that's
a very important part. I'll give you a second in a minute, Pums. I just want to finish this other point. I also think that all these politicians running to positions desperately, as we heard, you know, Colleen Makubele the other day trying to justify her run to MK, it's just survival. These guys don't know how to make it in the real world. They're politicians. They couldn't get a real job. No one would hire them. They don't have any skills to speak of. And I'm speaking generally here. There are obviously exceptions. But by and large, most of these people just won a popularity contest once. And then when they didn't keep winning that popularity contest, they suddenly thought, oh my God, where am I going to get my money? It's that venal. It's that basic. It's like, I need to pay for my current lifestyle, whether it's out of the park, outrageous, expensive, living in a huge big house and driving fancy cars, or whether it's just a very moderate and modest living. I don't know what each politician's lifestyle is. We should do audits across the board for all of them. But they're all just trying to survive, which shows you how basic they actually are. These are not brilliant people that are at the top. We call our leadership and we bow down. These are just ordinary, desperate, venal people who don't even necessarily have the skills of ordinary South Africans. They can't fix a pipe or dig a hole or lay a brick or any of those things that ordinary South Africans can do. So all they can do is run from position to position, hoping to get enough of us to back them. And all you have to do is ignore these people and they eventually go away. Don't vote for them and they go away because that's their game of survival. And some of them are not going to make it.
Thank goodness for that.
It becomes really sad. And let me move a little bit on the ANC. There's two things here. And I'm going to say things that will probably annoy a lot of people because, you know, they'll be like, why is he being so charitable towards the ANC? but I'll make two arguments here. Number one, you're absolutely right, Gareth. I agree with you insofar as from this point onwards, going forward, the ANC never recovers. That is just a simple fact. What do I mean by this? I will use the Western Cape example. Once the ANC loses, and loses bigly, as Trump says, it simply never comes back. So for me, that is a massive boon. It's a big plus. However, it's also, I'll infuse it with a bit of sadness in this respect, and hear me out. Anything to the left of the ANC is a very scary prospect. So even as I say the ANC never comes back and will remain in that 40, even sort of settling in the mid-30s at some stage, I view it at least that way. They are actually a little bit of a bulwark against the worst excesses of the South African racialized left. They are more tolerable, sort of quasi-leftist, racialized leftist formation. And I say tolerable with very loosely. But let me get to my point. Even as I say this, let's not fool ourselves. The ANC knows what to do. That's what makes the ANC such a tragic, a tragedy of our political times. This is a party that actually knows what to do to grow an economy, to create a, as I like to envision what South Africa should be, a free, prosperous, property-owning, and non-racial society. The ANC knows how to do this. Let me be precise and specific. The greatest years of growth in this country were at the tail end of these Mandela years into the Mbeki years, where we saw 5% year-on-year growth. And the data is absolutely crystal clear on this. Despite what the left and its Communist Party alliance partners were saying at the time, and the trade unions were saying at the time, it's jobless growth, they say. That's nonsense. You know, we're literally creating jobs like there's no tomorrow in this country. And let me go even one step further on delivery, because often people sort of malign those years of there's no delivery too. Look at how service delivery protests were rocketing up at the time. Yes, they were rocketing up because people were seeing that there's movement and they just simply weren't beneficiaries at the time because things were about to get to them. Again, this all sounds like opinion. Let me throw out some numbers. You know, for every one shack that was built in this country that period, 10 formal homes were built under those years. This is the sort of track record we're talking about. Jobs were created, as I said, in this country. 500,000 people were added to the work labor force in this country in those years. Plus, by the way, you know, we were on a very healthy trajectory. We were actually building savings as a government. I mean, there were years where government literally had surplus. In other words, they're funding the ever-increasing welfare.
Yeah, you left a surplus for Jacob Zuma. Yeah.
And right. I'll go one step further. They were actually even funding the welfare programs that were expanding on those savings. It wasn't debt at the time that was funding them. In fact, I'll go on an even further step. They were actually paying back the historical debts of apartheid. It was an amazing balance sheet at the time. So where did it go wrong? Where did it actually go wrong? It went wrong basically when the ANC then suddenly thought, you know, we're doing really well at the moment. Let's tinker with what our alliance partners are saying, you know, that we need to shift a bit more to the left and embrace that sort of mantra of building a national democratic revolutionary society, one which is socialist in nature, where we can build equity, a word I hate, by the way, but that's another issue for another day. We can build equity based on race in the society. And you then saw at that point, And a good friend of mine, Martin from Staden, did some excellent work here insofar as the number of race-based laws. In other words, laws that pick society's winners and losers based on race. You saw a massive ramp up of legislation like that, which scuppered the entire process. Why? Because suddenly you're moving away from what was and what could have been and what should have been a well-educated meritocratic society where people are viewed as individuals. And really, I talk a lot about the individual as a liberal, but really we're a family society. So insofar as policy, we should have viewed people as families and then made the argument as policy writers, how do we enrich or empower the South African family unit? Firstly, how do you encourage its formation? That is umama and umama in a home, more stable nuclear families. And then from there, use policy as government to empower family units in a non-racial way. So whether you're a poor white family in, I don't know where, you know, I'll just sort of make up a place at Brakpan, just for the sake of usual tropes that often here Gautengans use, or you're a poor black family in Alex, it becomes irrelevant. South African policy should have looked after you as a family by giving you a leg up. And what do we mean by a leg up? I don't mean BEE. I don't mean employment equity. I mean policies that actually we refer to in economics as enabling policies. Policies by the state that address three key areas as a avenue to empower society. One, safety and security. Nothing happens in a society if people don't feel that they're safe, both at a community level and also in terms of being able to conduct business in the societies they live in. Number two, health. Healthcare. You know, we have squandered in the last 30 years our ability to build a very expansive, well-funded, and professionally run public healthcare system. I would have preferred a system, for example, where we say, instead of the state running all healthcare, as is suggested by the NHI, how about we take the budget that we spend on healthcare, break it up into vouchers, and focus solely on poor people, ignore the rich, ignore middle-class people who already have. Those 9 million people who already have medical aid, they don't need the state's help in any way, nor do they need the interference of the state. What we need to focus on is poor South Africans. Whether they're black, white, Indian, or colored is irrelevant. Focus on poor people. Give them health vouchers so they can buy their own medical aid. And then those same public hospitals, which are so poorly managed by the state, either lease them out or sell them to the hospital groups who are clearly running world-class private institutions. Why shouldn't we have a MediClinic Santon management team also managing a Chris Hani Baragwanath, bringing that same quality to those facilities which absorb the vast majority of the public? That's the greatest indictment on healthcare in this country that the ANC must shoulder blame for, even now as it tinkers in a bad direction. Go ahead, Gareth.
Yeah, I love this conversation, but I just realized we've only got about 8 minutes left, and I do think it's valid for us to just refer to something that's in the news this week.
I want to ask one specific question, Gareth, before you move, because I actually wanted to ask after you. There is the General Assembly happening this week, UN General Assembly happening this week, and we saw...
The UN. The UN that no one listens to or cares about anymore. Have we ever asked them for their opinion on Russia, Ukraine? Has anyone ever listened? Have we ever asked them for their opinion on Israel and Palestine, except for the Palestinians who bay for blood all the time and the UN just kowtows to them? Do we care about the UN? Go ahead.
Well, Gareth, stop it, because I think it would be remiss to not ask Sihle specifically this question. As a black Jewish South African, did you see Cyril Ramaphosa's statement, particularly now in the face of a ramp up in the war in the Middle East? And what is your view? Because I think we hear a lot of what people think the view should be, and the South African government has taken a particular stance. So for you, as a both black and Jewish South African, what is your view on South Africa's stance, and particularly Cyril Ramaphosa's submission to the General Assembly?
Yeah, look, I'm not even going to frame it as a black Jewish South African. I'll frame it as a South African, period. I think it's a fundamental folly for South Africa to take sides on the international stage. It's completely as I often say on my show, it's a mumish. It's a proper mumish, insofar as we simply don't have the luxury to be able to do this. You know, we should be following a foreign policy in this country that builds friends with as many people as possible, and expresses a South Africa first foreign policy agenda. And I do not see how supporting one side on the Israel-Palestine conflict or Israel-Lebanon conflict is South Africa first. It simply isn't, especially when your biggest friend, realistically, are the Israelis. But let's leave that aside. I don't see how it serves us to take sides in the Russia-Ukraine conflict when realistically, you should be following a policy that favors and enhances South Africa's, on the one hand, standing, but also secondly, enhances our ability to trade and make money with everybody in the world. And beyond that, on the moral issues, to give us a leg, therefore, to be able to speak on the morality of what's happening internationally. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with South Africa being able to say, look, what country X is doing is wrong. It's, you know, and I don't mind that. But the issue becomes when you then full on bat for some of these rogue nations in some cases, and even terrorist organizations in the worst cases that we've seen the ANC do. In fact, I would argue it's one of the things that cost them support in the run-up to the election. If you remember back, you know, the ANC was shilling massively for organizations like Hamas and the like, and hiding behind doing it in the name of Gaza, when it simply wasn't the case. Everybody could see what was happening here. You know, here's an organization that was, you know, suggesting that these were their friends who supported them during their apartheid years, and therefore they should extend that same support today. On whose name? On whose name? Because South Africans broadly don't share the same view on these issues. So why does government think it can hold one view over another? But again, insofar as Cyril's speech at the UN, it was a bit, you know, again, sorry, I also echo Gareth's point here. Who cares about the UN to a large extent? It is a, you know, an old, yeah, it's...
It's like listening to the ANC Women's League. It's completely... No one gives a shit. It's all just, it's theater. It's performative. It's all like these nonsense nations all being given a chance to have their say about things that they're not involved in and have no sway over.
Absolutely. All of the above. But I'll go one step further. If you were going to listen to any speeches in that part of the world, and if you look at where the world is right now, yes, you would want to listen to the El Salvadorian president of Bukele, or actually, preferably, in my view, the president of Argentina. I forget his name.
Javier Milei.
There we go.
Sorry, I thought you said Bukele earlier on, Gareth. I don't know if you said Milei. Okay. But those would have been the two voices I would argue. If you want to sort of listen to nations that are heading in the right direction, it would be those two, to varying degrees and to lesser and greater extents. Yeah, I don't really care much about the UN. I don't really give much.
I want to ask you guys about something that is happening in KZN. It's relevant to the discussion that we've already had, but in some ways I think might be even more relevant, and I want to hear your comments. So the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure in KZN, it's a minister. I think he's a DA minister. I'm not sure.
Martin Mayer. He's been named a champ of the week on the show.
All right. So then you are the person to give us an opinion on this, a nice succinct opinion on this. In a groundbreaking move to enhance transparency and accountability, the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure in KZN successfully conducted the first full visual and audio recording of a supply chain management bid and tender committee. Now, this is not hard. It shouldn't be so revolutionary. The more light we shed on public goings on, especially when it's our money, let's not forget, this is not the government's money. That money is money they've taken from you at gunpoint. That's how taxation works. I want to know how my money is spent, not just in KZN, but all over the place. Why is it that these meetings must be held in these clandestine cloak and dagger places where there's shadowy this and that, no recordings, please. We'll have a handshake behind this pillar and no one will see. Here's a little bit... you is a little bit for me. I don't like any of that stuff. This doesn't seem like such a big deal, but it really, to me, should be.
Absolutely. And this is exactly why the GNU, let me circle back to where we began. This is exactly why the GNU has that optimism for a lot of people, because we're now seeing within government that contestation of ideas that brings new things, new in inverted commas, but brings new things into government which are desperately needed, things that err on the side of empowering the individual over the state, things that err on the side of encouraging transparency over that same cloak and dagger closed crony society type approach to government. For instance, this move that Martin Mayer, the MEC of Public Works and Infrastructure in KZN, has done has been something the DA have been doing in the Western Cape and city of Cape Town since as far back as 2006, when it first won Cape Town. The idea that tenders, insofar as they are prone to being corrupted, and it does happen, but you limit the ability of these things being corrupted if there is transparency. And literally, you can walk into a tender adjudication meeting, sit in and listen to the rationale, how they adjudicate these things, and it's open and transparent. You want that as a South African. And Martin Mayer, we called our champ of the week on one of our episodes of the Big Daddy Liberty Show, because off the jump, he had said, listen, if you are a tenderpreneur, or if you are part of the construction mafia in KZN, who, by the way, are a massive problem, lose my number. Do not even think that I'm here to entertain that status quo. I'm here to change it, in his words, and effectively bring transparency and a system that benefits residents, individuals, families, and not a closed crony loop society that we've become so unfortunately accustomed to. Number one. Number two, final gasp on this. In KZN in particular, you're now also seeing the police step up its efforts in fighting these individuals who have become a de facto government, in a sense, a shadow government. You know, these guys were literally walking into government officials' offices saying, listen, if you don't give me this tender, it's tickets for you and your family, or going onto construction sites and doing the exact same thing. Cops in KZN now, under General Mhlatla Mkhwanazi, who leads KZN police, are literally saying, obey the law, stop your nonsense, or I'll give you two options, a prison or a grave.
I like him too. I like Mkhwanazi as well. Let's give him some kudos this morning, because he's also someone who's trying his best to rectify a very ugly and dirty situation in that province.
Yeah, it's quite hectic. But you know, all of that broken record meme also requires that we as the citizens participate. So if the processes are open, if there are public participation platforms, then you must show up. And I'll tell you one case in point. I'm watching here the numbers of the people who have liked and subscribed to the show just this morning. But seriously, public participation does require that we do a little bit of work too. You know, it does mean that each and every one of us, we don't just end up at the I voted. Now I'm going to sit back and watch things happen. You have to show up. You have to make your voice heard. You have to be there in the council meetings, which are open, by the way. Absolutely. And whatever other public participation forums are happening, it's your chance to be part of the light that shines into these places.
Absolutely. And, I just caught myself being a very Jacob Zuma-esque there. I even cleared my throat. But that's absolutely true insofar as, and this will be my last gasp, because this is what we really want. And ironically, KZN is proving that it works. When government starts doing the right things, when government actually starts fulfilling its actual constitutional mandate to serve South Africans will participate in that. Let me be precise. One of the things Mkhwanazi often says in interviews is that we're now getting more intelligence from community members. They are the ones, because there's a trust relationship that's been built, who are pointing out these criminals who are hiding within these communities. And I would say, God bless this new impetus that we're seeing in government. God bless this new GNU, and let it more on the side of the individual, let it more on the side of policy reforms that serve us as families and not them as the political elites.
Love it. Well, you are, you may be verbose, but every word counts with you, and they're all very valuable, I think, a contribution to this show. But like Pumi said, and Pums, I heard there was a very direct challenge to the audience of this show. If you don't like and subscribe, then you're not doing your bit. So Pumi's basically strong-arming you into supporting us, which is great. I see no problem with that. Let this be your first bit of public participation, because if we don't have that support from you, then we can't do the show, blah, 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 blah. So there we go. Get involved.
Click the thumbs up button, guys, please.
How hard is that to do?
Tell your friends to come listen to the show. Thank you for being with us this week. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. That is the burning platform. Thank you, Sitle. We'll see you soon. And Pums, thank you very much. Coming up next is a conversation I had earlier this week with none other than our own JJ Cornish. We did our African Analysis episode. African Analysis, of course, is your opportunity to catch up on all the important information from across this continent before we start worrying about the UN and nonsense hot air speeches from politicians who no one is paying attention to. Even in the UN, they're probably fast asleep. Let's pay attention rather to what's actually going on around us, and in particular on this continent, which we call home. It is time for another episode of Africa Analysis, brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. They are very involved all over Africa, and there's no better way for you to get to grips with this continent and all the massive opportunities, possibilities it can bring your way from a business point of view and all kinds of other things. It's also good to know about your immediate environment. There aren't a lot of media outlets that focus on Africa, and we do it here every 2 weeks on Podcast Party. .co.za. You can find out more by going along to all of our different places, the normal places you'd get podcasts, to make sure you don't miss this one. Subscribe, and you can be a part of it every 2 weeks. Now, we manage to wrestle some time away from JJ Cornish every 2 weeks, and he is here today to tell us about some more interesting things from the continent of Africa. JJ, it's nice to see you. How are you?
Good to be back. I'm immensely well, thank you.
Excellent. So let us start in Uganda, a country with a very, very difficult past. I think it's right, and you can correct me if I'm not right, that since Idi Amin, there's only been one guy in charge the whole time.
No, Milton Obote took over from Idi Amin.
Ah, okay. Two guys.
It was 50 years ago that I met Idi Amin at the very United Nations General Assembly, which is sitting down here now. I gate crashed his dinner and walked up to him and told him that I have not been invited to your dinner, but I've decided I want to come here to meet you. He said to me, "Are you racist?" I said, "I don't believe I am, sir." Then he said, "You are welcome."
Wow.
Yeah, he pitched up at the UN, and I mean, everybody was absolutely scandalized that he should be received with such euphoria by the African group. They were delighted to have him there, and as I say, it was he shook my hand and said, "You are welcome."
Well, I'm glad he didn't eat you. That's all.
Or feed me to his crocodiles. Yeah,
feed you to his crocodiles, but. I mean, he's probably the most interesting guy, not always in a good way, that's ruled Uganda. The reason I said what I said at the beginning is probably because I've assumed that Yoweri Museveni has been there so long that he must have taken over straight away from Idi Amin in the 70s. But he has had 7 terms as president, right?
He's going for his 7th. He's been there since 1986. So he's been good. There a while, 40 years. Wow. And it's quite amazing. And his son, who is Muhoozi Kainerubaga, he's now the head of their defense force, but he was to stand with the next elections in 2026, but he's decided not to. The Lord has told him, no, you've got to maintain your command of the defense forces, and you must help your father's next presidential bid, which is for his 7th term.
All right, so the son wants to take over from the father, but then he decides, no, I'm not going to stand against my dad. What convinced him? What persuaded him not to stand against his own father in the election?
The word of the Lord. As in all things wicked in Uganda, God tells you to do it, you know. I mean, I suppose God might tell him to go and treat Bobby Wine badly because, you know, Bobby Wine is in a bit of trouble at the moment.
Yeah.
Bobby Wine is the most serious contender to Yoweri Museveni. And I don't know if Yoweri felt that he was the only guy that could keep Bobby Wine out, because he was the guy that actually seemed to be passing the baton to Muhoozi. But not this time. So we're in for at least another term round. Now, in 2021, there were 50 deaths in that election because Yoweri Museveni doesn't play... you know, he doesn't play a nice guy with elections. He won with 58% of the vote. At least he doesn't pretend to get, 90% or something. But he's a bad guy, there's no doubt. I remember the times I was working on the Sunday Independent, and they had a very bright correspondent there who kept aligning or likening Yoweri Museveni to Madiba, you know, and I remember railing against that and writing against it. And people said, you can't do this. You can't maintain that Madiba is the best African leader. People like Yoweri Museveni deserve their place too. Well, you know, not only do they deserve their place, but he threw out his anchor and he's hanging on to the chain to this day.
You know, it's amazing to me. I mean, the guy's been there so long that he used to wear a hat, almost like a kind of a frontier, almost American yes. parks and recreation hat. Does he still wear that? Because he must be very old now. He must be in his 70s, 80s even.
He still does. He disports himself with quite a lot of vigor, although it's a little while now since I've seen him. But he was, you know, at meetings and so on, he'd wear that hat. Yeah. The other one, of course, Salva Kiir, South Sudan. Also, man, he's a big, huge big hat, keeping the sun off him. Yeah. But no, Yoweri Museveni, he is, well, I don't know his exact age, but he must be well into his 80s or even his 90s by now. And that's probably why I thought he should hand over. But again, people, real challengers like Bobby Wine come along. I think he thinks I'm the only guy. You know, when you develop that belief that you're the only person that can run the country, I think it was Barack Obama who said, anybody who can't do what he has to do as president in two terms doesn't deserve to be there. You've got to boot him out.
Well, I call it Mugabe syndrome, but we all know how that story ended. Let's talk about Egypt, because that corner of the continent seems beset with all kinds of troubles. Ethiopia, still Somaliland, Somalia, and now Egypt are telling their own people to get out of Somaliland.
As quickly as possible, they say. Go out of Hargeisa, which is the airport in the capital of Somaliland. Get out as soon as you can. The thing is, of course, now Somaliland got independence as British Somalia in 1960. And the same as the Italian Somalia got independence the same time. Then the two of them joined together. I don't know if I've told you this tale before. Maybe I have. To form the Greater Somalia. That didn't happen. They were going to take parts of Kenya and form the Greater Somalia. So Somaliland gave up its sort of independence, so to speak, in the name of a greater cause. Didn't happen. Siad Barre took over. It was a coup. He took over, and he was a complete monster, and he turned on Somaliland, and he hit Hargeisa so badly that people say not one stone stood on another. The way he used Hargeisa Airport, the very airport that the Egyptians have to now escape to or from, to bomb the city of Hargeisa. So Siad Barre used his air force bombing the capital of Somaliland from Hargeisa Airport. Shocking. So when Siad Barre fell, yes?
Just remind me, what are the main reasons for Somaliland and Somalia having their differences? Is it cultural? Is it ethnic? Is it language? Is it religious? What's the main line of division there?
Well, the line of division being that the Somalilanders are different from the Somalis, or believe so, and then they had a greater hold. If you look at the Horn of Africa, that's seven, as it were. The top of the seven is Somaliland, and then there's Puntland, and then you go on to other territories. The point is, though, Siad Barre jealously wanted to promote Somalia, and that's why he, at the cost of the Somalilanders. That's why when he fell, the Somalilanders immediately declared independence. But in the interim, in that period between his fall in 91 and 1960, the African Organization of African Unity decided the only way they were going to clear up this whole colonial mess was to declare colonial boundaries sacrosanct. In other words, you could not gainsay them or counter them. The only one that's been able to do that, though, is Sudan, after one of the longest civil wars in Africa, and they allowed South Sudan to secede. It has been a difficult situation for them, too. But Somaliland has had five elections now. I've observed three of those, and they're a genuine democracy. But the OAU will not recognize them, and no African power, South Africa would like to, Ethiopia would like to, but they always say, we will be the second to recognize you. Somebody else has to take the lion's share first, or take the brave step first. So that's the situation. But now what Somaliland has done, it has given or ceded or leased to Ethiopia, which is landlocked because of their war with Eritrea. They've now a huge country, but landlocked. They've leased a huge section of their coastal strip along the Red Sea for Ethiopia to create a naval base. And that has sincerely pissed off the Somalians, and they are saying, you know, we are now at daggers drawn with Ethiopia. Our sovereignty is sacrosanct, and there are many within the African Union now that still agree on Somalian sovereignty and sovereignty over Somaliland, which is an error. There are lots of Western powers are present in Somaliland, but clearly they can't recognize Somaliland, you know, and run fly in the face of the whole African Union. So it's a fraught issue, but this is it could be developing into a fighting war if it doesn't quieten down now. And that is why Egypt has said to its people, get out now, because it's becoming unsafe.
Wow, that part of Africa is just fraught with problems, and who knows who's going to be able to solve them. But I'm glad for the update from you. Just one last thing before we go. Apparently, there's been a research center in Guinea that was ransacked by locals. Chimpanzees can be very dangerous. People forget this. A chimpanzee killed a worker's baby, so they decided, yes, we're tearing this place apart, and they did.
I hope you didn't read and think that I was going to give you a happy animal story to end it. A very sad one. This is the Nimba Mountain Nature Reserve. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. You know, the chimpanzees and their numbers have fallen 80% between 1990 and 2014. 80%. So they're radically, radically endangered. And this research station, UNESCO Heritage Site Research Station, working to forward advance the cause of the chimpanzees and to help them to increase their numbers. And but the problem is the food around that area, and there's droughts. I mean, the three areas where they have them are Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone. That's where the chimpanzees are located. And as you say, they're very dangerous. They turn on people, and they've been moving out of their safe zones because they have no food, moving into the human settlements. And there've been six attacks on humans this year by chimpanzees. But there was this woman digging up cassava, in the cassava field. She put her baby to one side. The chimpanzee came up to her, bit her, grabbed her infant baby, and took it off and killed it. So the locals have just gone berserk and broken up the research station. They're absolutely incensed. But a very, very, very sad story. Very sad for the endangered species, but, you know, just as sad for the humans. And a sad story to end on, I'm afraid.
Well, it's not always good news. We're all adults, though. We can accept that. Thank you for trying. And that is that is a look at some of the stories. I'm sure there are many more, but we're out of time. JJ Cornish, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And this is brought to you, this African Analysis, brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. Make sure you join us in 2 weeks' time when we get to hear some more of these interesting stories from JJ.